right? And at this time, I would like to introduce Michael from the Norvana area, and he's going to be sharing on Hope Turns to Faith. Let's welcome.
Thank you.
All right. I'm Michael. I'm an addict.
Michael.
And I love Narcotics Anonymous, and I welcome everybody, and it's just through the grace of God in this program that I stand here today and I'm alive. And I have to admit that this is very appropriate, this Hope to Faith, considering that the theme of this convention is despair to hope. And it made me reflect back quite a few days ago, and I love what this is all about here. Days, it's to me, it's all about living one day at a time, and I've been doing that for, they say, 10,717 days. And, which there was a time when I walked in here 30 years ago. I didn't get clean when I first came in here. But I came to Narcotics Anonymous because my best friend turned on me. And my best friend at the time was narcotics. And I love narcotics. And she walked out on me. And it was just me, myself, and I. And it was a scary proposition. And I had nowhere to turn. I had, by that time, my life, my wife at the time had wised up and got smart and left. And she took my most precious possessions in the world, which I called possessions then, were my children. And I had nowhere to turn to. And I ran into somebody on the streets. I grew up in the city of Washington, D.C., and they said, you know, why don't you try our Narcotics Anonymous meeting? Maybe they'd be able to help you. And surprise, surprise, my first meeting was in a mental health hospital in a psychodrama room. And it was a step meeting. And the step meeting, well, I think it was on step 9 or something. And I remember leaving that meeting, and I said, I got to go take care of some business. And the girl said, the woman grabbed me, she said, slow down, where are you going? I said, I got to go make some amends. And she says, there'll be plenty of time for that. But that was in September of 1983. And my clean date is December 10th, 1985. And slowly, the insanity of my life turned, have a little glimmer of hope. And the hope that I saw in Narcotics Anonymous was in these rooms. I came in and people were smiling and they were happy and they were hugging each other, which I thought was even weirder, because men were hugging men and women were hugging women. And you know, I wasn't that close to anybody at that particular time of my life there. I mean, to be honest with you, by then, people terrified me. I was scared of the human race. I was scared of myself. I was scared of what I was capable of doing to myself and to other people. And they just kept telling me, and they would smile when they said it, when they looked at me. They said, you just keep coming back. Just keep coming back. And I said, for how long? They said, don't worry about that. Just keep coming back. Every day, go to a meeting. And when I first started in Norvana, there was only 5 meetings a week. So there was no way of not going to a meeting every day. Because if you didn't show up at a meeting every day, everybody knew that you did not show up at a meeting. And it was a small little network. And, you know, I've watched it grow over the last 30 years to be in this monstrous program. And I have, you know, so many friends and so many people that I love and who have cared for me through all these years there. And just slowly did my did I start to learn to have faith in a power greater than myself, because I thought that I could overcome this disease with willpower, and that if I just made some adjustments, that I would be all right. You know, I went through quite a few rehabs from 83 to 85, and they nicknamed me the 90-day wonder. I do have enough chips to probably start my own little casino in Maryland, and that I keep. And they're a good reminder for me, a constant reminder of who and what I am and how hard-headed I was and where I came from. And you know, but slowly, you know, weird things started happening to me. You know, somebody gave me a job, and you know, and my life started to get a little bit better, and I mean a little bit better. And then, but I had this thing with this 90-day experience of something would always come up. And my favorite one, and it's my last one, is I'm a contractor and I'm working in this house. And you know how us dope fiends are. I think we can smell drugs a mile away. I'm in this house and I'm looking around and I'm looking at just the way these people live. And I said, it's like a college house. And I'm like, there's drugs here. I can just sense it. I can just feel it. And, you know, that's when I started realizing there was a higher power. And something said, get out of here. Go call your sponsor. And the other side said, oh, you can handle this. And so I started nosing around. You know, I went up into the bedroom. And there was, yes, a mirror on the dresser. And, you know, by then my stomach's flipping. Because I've been through this now probably about 10 different times since I found the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. And to be honest with you, I was terrified. I was so scared, I was trembling, and I'm surprised I didn't piss in my pants. I mean, I was shaking. But I opened up this drawer, and there was a whole bag of friggin' cocaine. And, you know, by then I said, well, let me see if it's for real. Maybe it's just a trick. But I'll never forget how powerful and cunning this disease is, because that's the last time I used, is that I put my finger in that bag and I touched it to my tongue, and that's all it took. And I remember just saying, well, they're not going to miss this much, and boom. I made myself a snow seal, and I was out the door, and I was downtown, and I knew exactly where to go and what to do. And that bender probably lasted for about 3 days. And, you know, I have to admit how crazy and I was, and I still can be sometimes, as an addict. I went back in that house when the people were there that night and told them I left my tools upstairs, and I had to go back up there and get it. And I went back into the same drawer and dumped some more stuff into my little bag. And well, I finally got through this binge, and I went to my sponsor. And, you know, it's just an honest program I was learning. So I had to open up and share it. But I never expected him to tell me that I had to go make an amends. I had to go pay for the stuff that I just used. And I had to go knock on the door. And I had, when the people were home, and I had to admit what I had done and say, here's some cash for what I had taken. And I tell you, that was probably one of the most humbling and humiliating experience that I've had, one of them that I've had in recovery there. And you know, that was the last time that I used, and I just, you know, I just kept coming back, you know, and it's just, and going to meetings, you know, and I got a sponsor, and, you know, he just said, call me every day, And I did. I called this guy at 4 o'clock in the morning because he was an early bird. And I sat on his, and I would sleep on his couch. And for 5 years, you know, we were probably like butter on bread, you know. And this guy really saved my life, and he taught me about the program of recovery there. And he walked me through the steps, which, you know, I didn't have any problem admitting that I was powerless. But I did have a problem admitting that my life was unmanageable there, and because I thought that I could deal with this disease of addiction there, and through all my experiences, I found that I could not. And he helped me to, you know, to walk through and to deal with the step one, and then to work on to step two, which, you know, talks about a came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, because I was so insane for the first couple of years of being insane, I mean of being clean. when I walked into a job, everybody left. And I still have a couple of friends like that these days. You know, it's just that no one knew how I was going to react or how I was, if I was going to go off. And, you know, some people don't believe that I was ever like that, but I still have the fond memories of how crazy I was when I got here. I was so self-absorbed, so self-centered, and so all me that it was hard for me to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I had no concept of a power greater than myself there. And, you know, it took, then I moved on to, you know, to step three, you know, and I turned my will and my life over, learned to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than myself there. And, events started happening in my life. You know, my children were taken away from me when during my addiction, and I didn't see them for 3 years. And then I was about 3 years clean, and the phone rang, and they go, "Hey, Dad, this is your children. You got some kids," and they wanted to come and see me. You know, I was warned that I need to be prepared. You know, these were little kids. They were like 3 and 5 years old when they left, and they were like, I don't know, about 7 and 10 when they were reunited with me. And, you know, I was still, when you reflect back, when you're young and in recovery, your emotions are really just sort of like very, very tender. And, you know, and they said they would put them on an airplane. I could pick them up at National Airport, and this, and in my mind, I had this, just envisioned this grand reunion. And I remember at the time, my sponsor said, you know, just, you better pray about this, because, you know, this might not quite be the way you think it's going to be there. And, you know, I'll never forget the day that they walked off the airplane with the stewardess, and they walked down the, through the areaway there, and she just goes, "Well, do you see your dad?" And, you know, my heart was broken, because, you know, my children, they didn't recognize me, and they walked right past me. And, you know, the reunion was tough. You know, and it was these times of difficulties that, where through my sponsor and my other confidants here, you know, they told me that I had to develop this relationship with a power greater than myself. And it was important for me to learn to, you know, to pray. And and I had no clue. The only time I ever prayed was when, you know, I had that foxhole mentality. You know, when I was in a jam, I'd say, "God, get me out of this, and I'll never do it again." But, you know, once I got out of it, I always did it again, and time after time. And you know, I started to build this relationship, and I started to work the steps, and I started to make amends, and started to look at who and what I was and what I was all about, and started to form this relationship with a power greater than myself, which I care to call God today. And through the coincidences and the miracles that started to unfold in my life, it became easier for me to develop this relationship and become closer. And I've been on this spiritual quest ever since I've gotten here. And it's gotten better and better and better. I mean, I've been through a lot of difficult times. And getting clean, as we've all know, it doesn't exempt us from life shit. Life shit happens. You know, I've lost my parents. I've lost a lot of friends in recovery who've died from either gone back out or from natural causes. But I've not found it necessary to pick up. And, you know, I've learned to pray and to work on this relationship with my power, which I call God. And early on, I was told by a friend of mine, he asked me about my praying habits. I said, well, you know, I'm driving down the road in the morning going to work. You know, sometime I'll talk to God a little bit. Or if I'm sitting on the toilet when I get up in the morning, I'll talk to God. And he goes, you know, why don't we try a different approach here? And he goes, why don't you try hitting your knees and developing this relationship with this power, considering it's supposed to be your friend and it's supposed to be greater than you. And, you know, probably for about 25 years now, every morning I get up and the first thing I do is I hit my knees and I ask God for the strength and the courage to get through this day to carry out His will and the power to carry it out. And just, you know, to be an example of this program and how He would want me to carry myself. Because, I mean, we all go through difficult times. You know, I went through difficult times with my kids being reunited into my life, and I had to end up learning how to trust in the people here, and then I needed to learn how to trust in my higher power. The first thing they told me about my kids was they said, you know, you stay clean, all that other stuff will take care of itself. And all that other stuff did take care of itself. You know, I didn't have to be in control of everything and be in the center of it there. And as my journey went on, you know, I was tested multiple times in recovery, but I never found it necessary to use. And, you know, I am a very, very gifted individual. I feel very grateful to be alive and to be here, like most of us. In 2002, you know, I had never gone to the doctors like most of us. And, you know, I found out that I had hepatitis C and I had cirrhosis 4 and that I needed to immediately get a transplant. But the way I am, it's like, you know, I felt too good and I didn't want to get a transplant. And so I just played with this for years and years and years. And, you know, worked on my relationship with my higher power and had faith that everything was going to be all right. And, you know, 2 years ago, you know, I was gifted with the gift of a new liver. And to me, it's the most precious gift other than recovery that one human being could ever receive. And, you know, it's really easy for me today to have faith in a higher power, because I don't know what happened. Some people call it cellular memory. Some people might call it a continual spiritual awakening. But I feel that I was totally touched that day. And, you know, there's no more big deals in my life. And the people who are close to me now know things don't bother me like they did 30 years ago when I walked in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I don't wish to kill people like I did before. I don't, you know, there's times when I'm driving down the road and people flip me the bird because I'm talking on my cell phone, which I do probably too much anyway. Or, you know, and they look at me, but you know, there was a time when somebody would flip me the bird. I was hot after them, and I was right on their ass, and I would probably cause an accident or something like that. And, you know, today I can blow them a kiss and say, you know, have a good day, and, you know, everything's all right. But it's, you know, it's taken, it's a, you know, I'm on this spiritual quest, but it's a process. It's something that I've learned from my experience takes time, and it took this many days. And it continues to take more days. But each day that I get up, I feel that I am totally, totally blessed with another day of being clean. And I am so grateful for the program of Narcotics Anonymous and my relationship with my higher power. You know, God does for me what I've never, never, never been able to do for myself. And all I have to do is get up and just continue to follow that path which has been laid for me. It's very easy for me, and you know, I'm just grateful to and honored to be asked to come up and share on this topic of hope and faith. And thanks a lot there.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Michael. Now it's time for me to introduce our next speaker, and she'll be sharing a hope turns to faith. This is my spiritual mother. She's from the Savannah area. Let's give Linda a hand. All right.
Thank you, my daughter. I love you too. I'm an addict. My name is Linda. First of all, I want to say that thank you, Michael. Thank you very much for being willing and committed to do service here in Narcotics Anonymous and to come share some of your experience, strength, and hope with us today. And secondly, I would like to thank the Dulles Corridor area for asking me to come and share some of my experience on when hope turns into faith. I'm very honored by my friend who asked me. I don't need to mention his name, but he has been a friend of mine for quite a while. And I was really shocked, but I do thank you all for asking me. And I thank all you all who showed up here today, because without you, a person like me could not stand up here and share. And I'm a little nervous, I don't know why. But I'm just a little tad nervous, so bear with me, my family. When I heard the topic, hope turns into faith, I said, I don't know about that one. And then I got to think about the first step, and then I got to think about the second step, and I got to think about the 11th tradition. And I said, I don't really know. So I'm just going to tell you how I feel based on my own experience here in Narcotics Anonymous, and before coming to N.A. When I came here in 1992, I came here by way of avoiding prison in Winchester, Virginia. I love drugs, like Michael was talking about. He was my man, my husband. He was my everything. And when I got arrested, hopefully for the last time, the detective at James Madison University, they had to come arrest me before they could take me to the big jail in Harrisonburg. And he asked me, after all these questions and talking to me, he said, Linda, do you think you have a drug problem? And at that time, tears just flowed down my face. I was boo-hooing all over the place, needed to blow my nose and everything because I was full of drugs, and I knew I couldn't run no more, and I couldn't hide, and they was taking me to jail again. And so I said, I guess so, I don't really know. And he went in his top suit coat, and he took out this handkerchief, and he gave it to me. And I wiped my face and cleaned up a little bit. He said, well, I'm sorry, I got to take you over to the main jail and have you arrested. And I said, what am I going to do? I have a daughter. I had a young daughter. I had no family in Harrisonburg, Virginia, nobody but me and my daughter. And nobody could take care of her. And she was staying with a lady named Miss Creola. And I didn't know when I was getting out of jail this time. And so I went to jail, and I stayed there for a little while. But I still miss drugs. I still miss my drugs. I missed my preliminary hearing on that Monday because they arrested me on a Saturday morning, and you're supposed to go to court right after you get picked up. And so that would have been Monday morning. I was asleep, and nobody couldn't wake me up because I was full of so much drugs. It just couldn't wake me up, so they just let me sleep. And so I had to have my preliminary hearing the next day. But eventually, I stayed in jail for a while that time. I stayed in jail for a while that time. And when I got out, April the 29th, 1992, they ordered me into this program in Winchester, Virginia. It was called the Detox Center, Starting Point, Inebria Center. It was the Johnny Foreman's place. That's what they called it. Everybody in Winchester called it the Johnny Foreman place. That's where you go and you, it's similar to a jail, where you go in, you get three meals a day, you go to a lot of meetings, you get your job, and if you mess up, you get on, you know, you violate your probation and whatnot, and they send you back to court and whatnot. So I was in this program, and I asked the judge, could I go see my daughter? And he said, you're a minister to this city. You done violated the trust of everybody here in Harrisonburg, Virginia. You either go straight from here to Winchester or you go straight from here to Gooseland. And I didn't want to go to Gooseland, so I took Winchester as an option. I came to Winchester, and Johnny told me I need to go to meetings. And there weren't many at Narcotics Anonymous meeting at that time in 1992. In Winchester, there was the Monday night, Wednesday night, and the Thursday night meeting. They had a Saturday night meeting. They had four meetings of Narcotics Anonymous in Winchester, Virginia. Now they got a meeting every day in Winchester, and thank God for that. And so I had to go to some AA meetings. I admit that. I had to go to some AA meetings, but Johnny knew I was an addict, and he used to call me Crack Crack. I was the only woman in detox at the time. In 1992, and I was the only African-American woman, and there were some other issues that I had to deal with, but that's neither here nor there. I identified out for a long, long time when I came here, but he used to call me Crack Crack. He said, Crack Crack. I ain't never seen no woman. He said, I ain't never seen a woman 38 years old, knows how to cook up dope and all that stuff like that, because he had no concept of drugs. He really didn't, because he was an alcoholic. He was a recovering alcoholic, and that was his program. But he used to call me Crack Crack, and he used to call my friend Bruce C., who was another brother, and he said, you two, you sure y'all two haven't been using drugs together? Because we knew so much about the drug life and can tell him about bricks and stuff like that. And so I still didn't like Winchester. I wasn't liking no meetings. I knew I had to go. And so I met this guy sitting on the curb one day named Nigel. Nigel was my brother, and Nigel was my best friend. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. He was my brother, and he was my best friend. And I was sitting on the curb, and Nigel said, what are you doing sitting on the curb? He said, you in Johnny's? I said, yeah, I'm in Johnny's. He said, come on, go inside with me. So we went in there, and he talked to Johnny because he knew Johnny. He said, Johnny, I need this girl. And Johnny said, what you need her for? You ain't taking Crack Crack nowhere. No, Nigel, you can't have Crack Crack. You turn into a bad girl. No, Nigel, I know you. I know you. Nigel was even bad to Johnny. But because they had similar issues, I'm going to tell you that right now. They had a lot of issues alike. But anyway, Nigel said, real, John, I need her. And so Nigel took me to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and it became my home group. It was called the Last Connection Group of Narcotics Anonymous. And there was Bill M. there. There was a whole lot of people there. There was Lamont. Lamont has since left us. He passed away in 2010. Lamont was there, and I had a whole lot of friends that I met in Narcotics Anonymous that I could identify with because we was of the same color, and it was a lot of brothers. There was a lot of brothers, so, you know, that was my element. And I still had my behaviors. I still had, at that time, I'm 60 now. I'm 60. I'm age 69. So let me tell you right. At that time, I was 38. I had the tiny waistline. And I still had the hips. And so I look good. Believe me. I look good. And I hadn't been out of jail long. And I still knew how to work my program. That program. That was another program. I knew how to do that. And Nigel and Lamont and Kennedy, they used to come pick me up on Monday nights, Wednesday nights, and Thursday night. And they would take me to the Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And Nigel was so cold-blooded to me, he would come inside. Hell no. You're not wearing them shorts all the way up in the crack of your butt. No. Cover up them things up there. Cover them up. My sister ain't going out here looking like that. You're not living that life no more. Them days is over with. And, you know, those guys respected me, and they cared enough about me, and they taught me how to become a lady in Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm very grateful to those men, and will always be grateful. They were healthy men. They had a lot of respect for me, and they weren't trying to get in my pants or nothing like that. But I was trying to get into other newcomer pants now. I need to be honest. I was trying to do that. And they taught me about that, too. They say, you robbing somebody. And I understand no robbing. But let me tell you something. I kept going to these meetings. I kept going to parole and probation, doing my meetings. And I got my first job at McDonald's, making $52 a week. And I was so grateful for that. I had come from like $35,000 a year back in the 90s and the late 80s at James Madison University, $52 a week. And I was very grateful for that because you know why? I was not in jail, and that's all that mattered to me. And I was able to see my daughter, even though she was still in Harrisonburg. Miss Criolla would bring her down to visit me on the weekend. But I went to an NA meeting for a whole year, and I would see people be clapping and be so happy, and they'd be hugging each other, and they'd be fighting over their coffee. They got to have coffee. And I don't drink coffee. I don't drink coffee to this day. They come into me, and they wouldn't even hardly speak to each other, but they had to have a cup of coffee. And I said, something must be in that coffee that's really making them happy. But they love their coffee. And Bill taught me how to come to the NA meeting with him on Wednesday night, and we'd go down there around about 6 o'clock, and we'd stand there, set the chairs up, we'd put the literature out, and he said, he started calling me Crack Crack, too. He said, Crack Crack, you... I said, my name is not Crack Crack, my name is Linda. And he would say the reason why he liked to come down to the church early, because sometimes that's the only way he can only get in touch with a God of his own understanding. And that was okay with me. And so I had a year, and I had never picked up a key tag. And on my first year, some of y'all know this, I picked up my 30-day key tag, my 60-day key tag, my 90-day key tag, my 6 months, my 9 months, and I picked up my one-year key tag, and that was the first sign I knew I had some hope. That was my first sign of hope. That was my first sign of hope. I knew I was not that guttural, sometimes slutty, and y'all know the rest of the B words and all that, that I thought I was when I came in there. I didn't think I was no longer that bad criminal and whatnot, but when I picked up all of my key tags, that was the first sign I felt a hope. And I get goosebumps all over me right now. And I got all them key tags right now at my house, on my mantle. I got all my key tags. And I got them all hooked together to remind me of who I am and where I come from. And I don't never have to go back to them days before 92 again if I choose not to. And so when I got my 3 years clean, when I came to 3 years, and then I started getting a little happier. I settled down just a little bit. But I didn't have a sponsor. But I was still going to meeting, and I was just doing the process of what probation wanted you to do. You know, just go to meetings, get them people to sign the sheet of paper, like they still do today. And I would talk to Johnny. I'd go by there and see him as I got out of detox. I'd go by there and see him, talk to him. And he set me down with the books. And we'll talk about what was going on in the books. Will you pass my water, Michael, please? Excuse me. Thank you. Excuse me, Sherry. He would talk to me about reading in the books and whatnot. And he said, crack, crack, my name to this day, where Johnny is concerned, is still called crack, crack. But he said, you're a beautiful crack, crack today. He tells me I'm a beautiful crack, crack today. So when I got 3 years clean, I got my 3 years first, and Bill had more years than I did, and his anniversary is also in February, like mine's. I think it's February the 19th, either February the 20th, one of them 2 days. But anyway, Bill got, and his wife was at the meeting, and after the meeting was over with, she came up to me, and she said, you need a sponsor. I said, who are you? I asked her, who was she? And she said, don't worry about who I am, but you need a sponsor. I said, no, I don't. And I said, why do I need a sponsor? You need somebody to help guide you, because you can tell by your outsides that you really need some help and that you want some help, but you don't know how to go about getting no help. And I did not know that Bill had already planned this. Bill had planned this with his wife. He said, when you come to the meeting tonight, slowly introduce yourself to my girlfriend. He calls me his girlfriend. He calls me and Karen his girlfriend. He said, slowly introduce yourself to my girlfriend, because she is nothing to play with. And so I said, I don't know who you are or where you come from, but I think you need to get out of my face, because I don't need no sponsor. And at that time, I was having some internal issues, like some of you all know, with the other race, because I'm from Mississippi. And he understand where I'm coming from. Me and her, we on this side of the track. Railroad Bob, Trish, and Sarah, y'all on that side of the track. And the two don't come together, not in Mississippi. So that doesn't leave you because you come here in Narcotics Anonymous. It takes some work. It takes some work, and it takes you getting a sponsor, getting into the step process, and actually putting it on paper and being willing to share this honestly. And so this lady knew this about me through her husband, who was immersed in this program. That's how the program really works for me. And so Bill came over, and he said, have you met my wife? I said, oh, my God. I said, this is your wife? He said, yeah, this is my wife. I said, Bill, that lady told me I need a sponsor. He said, you do. We've been telling you that for quite a while, but you won't listen. And so she said, here's my number. Call me, and we'll go get together and have some breakfast or something. So I called her that Saturday morning. And she came pick me up, and we went to breakfast that Saturday morning around about 9:30, 10 o'clock. Do you know I was still with that lady at 5 o'clock that Saturday? We spent the entire day together that day, and I asked that lady to become my sponsor. And that was the best thing I ever did, because the issues that I was dealing with internally, they had a profound effect on how my using had come about. My using came about as a result of my working on me and my fourth step by two reasons. One, I felt I always needed a man make me be the woman I needed to be. That was one. Two, when I left the state of Mississippi and came to the Commonwealth of Virginia, I knew who I was in Mississippi. But once I got to Virginia, I felt so ostracized by white females that it was very hard for me to have anything to do with a white woman. Anything. So that progressed my using for years and years. I never used with a white woman. Never. Used with a lot of white guys, but the white guys never did make me feel that way. Because you know how they say, they pat that butt, they're going to do this to that butt, they're going to do that to that butt, but it's going to be some woman. There's going to be some woman that got to come along here and save my butt. And I believe that to this day. You know, and I have felt so bad for years. It just wasn't going to work. So me and Becky got together, and she took me through my first step by my unmanageability, what I was powerless over my daughter, powerless over the probation officer, powerless over a lot of things. She took me through my second step. But when she got to my second step, that is when she said I helped her more than she helped me, because she never believed in the things that I believed in. I believe before I came to Narcotics Anonymous, and I think that was not because of necessarily my predecessors. I think it was because of the raising I had by my grandmother. I believe that when I got up in the morning, I always was able to get up by my grandmother by getting on my knees and saying thank you. I always believed that. My grandmother ingrained that in my head. So when I was using, a lot of things I did while I was using, I felt so bad about, because I had went against the grain of the faith and the God of my understanding, who I knew lived inside of me. Now, I'm not trying to say I'm religious or anything like that, but I knew if I used and whatnot, every time I used, if I saw a church or something like that, I go the opposite direction. Because I knew something bad was going to happen. I just knew bad was going to happen. But Becky helped me, and she said, "Linda, help me understand what this faith is." I said, "Becky, it's like when you get up in the morning and you put your feet on the floor, you really can't see what helped your foot get on the floor. You can't see what helped open up your eyes in the morning. It's like something intangible that the basic text talks about. The basic text talks about that faith comes about as a result of something being intangible. It's like a supernatural, yet it's ingrained within us naturally. And that helped us develop a faith, and we come to believe in something better than me, stronger than me, and more powerful than me, and it loves me no matter what. Whether it be a rock, whether it be this bottle of water, it doesn't matter what it is. For a long time, it was them people in Narcotics Anonymous in my home group, because we had a large home group, and my home group kept me clean for a long time, and I believed in them. You know, they call you. You ready to go to the meeting? You need a ride? They take you out for coffee. And see, that was the best part about it. You go out to Shonis, and I get them fudge cakes. I get them fudge cake, and I get them sodas and stuff like that. I like that. And we sit around, and we'll talk, and we'll tell what's going on. Well, I need to go see my probation tomorrow. Linda, you gonna be clean? Yes, I'm clean. I'm gonna be clean. And then somebody will say they need to go pay their electric bill and they don't have all the money and stuff like that, but they going to work and they get paid tomorrow and blah, 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 and they go take care of it. So for a long, long time, I learned that no matter what, if I keep coming to Narcotics Anonymous, if I keep believing what y'all tell me, if I keep following y'all's suggestions that you give me, if I keep calling my sponsor, guess what? I have faith. Because by her having the time that she had and by her being willing to talk to me and listen to me, because that's all we really need. We just need somebody to listen to, at least I did. I needed somebody to listen to me because my head was so scrambled and confused, and it gets like that sometimes today. But I need somebody just to listen to me and listen to what I got to say first. And if you listen to me intently, then I know you believe in me. And guess what? I can do the same thing for you. And so it's a two-way street. And so that's where my faith is, because I believe in Sherry, and Sherry believes in me, and we talk about issues that we have. Because not too long ago, me and her were struggling. The two of us were struggling about our children. I got a daughter. She has a daughter. I wasn't able to see my daughter for 2 years. I wasn't able to see my grandkids, and that tore me up. And the people in NA kept telling me, keep on praying, Lana. Keep on praying. Keep on getting on your knees. Because you know what? I was telling one of my good friends, my brother, he says I'm his big sis. But I say he's like my son. He's like a little cuddly bear son of mine. I was telling him coming up here that it's hard to stumble when you get on your knees. It is very hard to stumble when you get on your knees. And you only find that out by coming to Narcotics Anonymous. Now, don't get me wrong. Nothing has happened for me in 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. It has taken me some work. And I've been here a few 24 hours too, like Michael was saying. But I believe in the step process. I believe in talking to everybody. And Becky also taught me when we got to my fourth step. Oh, my God. You know how a lot of people tell you, that's the boogeyman step. I said, what's so bad about the fourth step? It ain't no different than any other step, I guess. And so I went, did my fourth step at our house on Fairmont Avenue, and we sat on the floor, and we held hands in front of each other. She on that side, I'm on this side, and we prayed, and we started talking about the fourth step, and she said, let me tell you something right now before we get started. A fourth step is only a listing of your assets and your character defects. And the best part about the fourth step is just to get on the other side. And that was important for me. That was real simple. See, Becky understood me. I like things real simple. Don't complicate it, because if you complicate it, there you go. Now you're causing problems, because I'm going to ask questions all day long. And then she's going to say, don't analyze nothing. I said, well, you kept it complicated for me. So what am I to do? Ask questions. That's the only way I'm going to understand. And it's like peeling away that layer. Each layer she taught me. But I found out by doing my fourth step and how I came back to my second step was that no matter what I do, no matter what I think and what I say, and if I talk to y'all about it, guess what? It gets better and better and better. And each day that I choose not to pick up and use, things get much, much better. I love this program. If anybody knows me, really, truly knows me, I have a passion for Narcotics Anonymous. I will bug you to death. I will bug you by coming to a meeting. I will bug you by doing some service work. I will bug you by buying my spaghetti tickets, which I got here today. I will bug you by my spaghetti tickets. I will bug you by getting involved in the convention. I will bug you by getting involved in H&I. And by the way, we do need your help. We do need your help in H&I. H&I needs some help. And I bug people by coming to my home group. On Thursday night, I have a step and a traditions home group. It's called The War Is Over. And when Ronnie and Rob said last night, you know, they said this, and they couldn't say it right. I could see it much better. They said they belong to the exact nature. I said, oh, they need to say the exact nature.
Right.
The exact nature of Narcotics. They need to be proud of their home group. You know, put some enthusiasm on it. But I thank y'all for coming out here this evening. I love y'all. And y'all have really helped me. And I hope I've helped someone out here, too. Thank y'all.
Let's thank our speakers, Michael from Nirvana and Linda from Savannah. Okay, all right. And we're going to close this with a serenity prayer, please, the we version. Serenity prayer. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, just for today. Thank you.
Just for today.
Hi, Paul. Okay,
how are you?
Good. Now I'm supposed to give this to, where the guy that? I'm good, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
Hello, dear.
How are you?
Rinsing them pads, but you smell good. I'm like Ray Charles now.
Just keep coming. Michael,
okay. Hey, Michael, I'm Michael.
Where the guy at? Where's the guy that, who am I supposed to get these to? Okay, yeah, that worked. Excuse me.
Thank you.
I will.
Oh, yeah, Georgia, 7th Street.
I know you know where that is.
No, I wasn't that far up. No, I lived up there in the Flower Streets.
Okay. Or like near Wall Street Hospital.
Oh, yeah.
My dad was in the military.
Yeah. And Somerset and a lot of people.
There was Longfellow, and then there was Fern.
My brother's wife, the first wife. They were from
military.
No town?
What do they call it? Reagan.
I see what people love Griffin Stadium.
I remember when they tore it down.
Yep.
They built a house.
It was only about that big, but I remember going to one baseball game then. 58.
Okay. I'm 63. And I remember, see, where y'all went in, that little street on 5th Street. And he had the Elton Street coming to it. He lived right there on 4th Street. Yeah. Back in the day, I remember going through these alleys and you hear the guy saying, okay, they get ready to hit a ball.
I was there during the riots and everything.
And I remember my sister was going to Easton.
St. John College out there on Military Road.
St. John. Yeah. I remember that.
I ended up going to Carroll because
Is that right?
After that, my brother went to Coolidge.
Uh huh.
And then they said, man, if you go to Coolidge, you ain't gonna live, because they just knew how I was.
Uh huh.
So they put me in a private.
You went to Carroll. Okay.
I couldn't handle Carroll. Then they sent me over to Wilson. I went to Wilson.
Okay. Yeah. Wilson over there. Uh huh. Okay, Mike.
Look at that, man. You're up there with me. You've been hanging around for a long time.
Sure have.
So we're starting to get dusty, man.
Yep. One day at a time.
Oh, it's a great program.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a life giving. Yeah. The last person deserved, a precious gift like an organ would be someone like me. You know, and it's like, God gave me the perfect one. I mean, there's no coincidence. Like, my man was like, never drank, he never smoked, and he was never married, he never drove, he never missed a day's worth of work in 37 years, and he walked 8-10 miles a day, and he was 80 years old. And they doctor said, he's 80 years old, you want this? You know, it's between you and God. And when that thing showed up, he said it looked like it was fresh out of the hop.
When you was up in D.C., did you go up to the meetings up to the Metropolis?
I never went to the Metropolis, what was Jack's name? Remember Fast Eddie? Did you know Fast Eddie?
Yeah, I knew Fast Eddie. Then you had Al Wood up there. Matter of fact,
I remember Al.
What's his name? be up. Where's Jim Vance? He must be up.
Jim Vance, yeah, Vance. He's
how much time does Jim have now?
About the same as we did.
Okay, because I remember being introduced in the room in 83. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? I stuck around until about 85 and went back out. Because
they all went up. Did you ever go up to Connecticut Avenue? There was meetings there?
That's where he was at, up there.
Yeah, he was up at Conscious Contact.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's a blessing, man. I've been living on the Eastern Shore down here now for 7 years.
Oh, really?
You know? It's a blessing. Nice and peaceful and quiet, and I love fishing.
Well, if you love fishing, you're in the right place there, man. Me, I'm still working, man. I love working. I never thought I'd go back to work, man. But
where are you working now?
In D.C.
Okay. Yeah,
I just do construction. But
okay.
I mean, all of a sudden, I mean, I didn't have any problems. I mean, I slept for 3 days after surgery, woke up, and they told me I'd go on home. I went home and just started to, first you go down. I went down pretty far for about a month. But then all of a sudden, I started exercise. And then I went and met my donor's family, which they were from Pittsburgh. And that was real emotional.
Yeah, my lady friend, she's from Pittsburgh. Actually, the couple that was sitting in front of me, they're from Pittsburgh. She's from Pittsburgh. Wilkinsburg.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's big.
Man. It's a great program, and I tell you. I mean,
and you meet some good people, man.
You know,
like they say, you know, this is our family here, but the family here taught me how to get back in touch with my real family.
Yeah, and I have a relationship. You know, it was through this program that I was able to, you know, have a relationship with my parents. And then as they got older, my mom lived to be 90. She lived in the same house up on 16th Street.
Is that right? Okay.
That was my dad's only wish when he died, like 12 years before she did, to take care of him. He asked me, I'm the fifth child out of eight. He asked me to take care of her. I'm like, and all my brothers and sisters go, why are you asking you? I said, because I guess he trusts me.
Yeah. Well, parents see something in kids, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
And my parents, both of mine did. My mom died in 1980. My father died in 2000.
But it was nice to be able to make amends. Because when I was a little kid, man, my dad told me one time when my sister was born. He said, if my sister, the fifth sister, my fifth daughter, he said, if she had been a boy, he said he couldn't. He would have had a heart attack. He was dying. He said he couldn't. If he had had another son like me, he said that would have been him. And he was tough too.
My dad was 6'3", 350.
Well, mine was. I'm the smallest. I'm the runt. I'm the litter. My brother, 14 months younger than me, 6'8", 225.
You tall? How tall are you? 6'6"?
And I told him here. That's one of the first times I had to see my dad, right? If my dad, you spoke over Dr. Cigar, right? He would never, if he come out looking for you, he would never call. He would get his head back. Or if he got mad at you, he would bite down on that cigar. Out there, if you show him, you knew then that, hey, you went for it when you get home.
I was so crazy. I'll never forget the one time when I was about 15, 16 years old, and you're starting to get that macho shit in you. And my dad, he said something to me, and he had me pinned in a corner. And I told him, I said, what the fuck are you doing? And his eyes opened up like that, and he cocked back like that. And I ducked, he hit that wall, and I was out the door. They wouldn't let me come home for 5 days. It took them 5 days to cool off.
Yeah, that's right.
He grew up in Brooklyn.
Okay.
And then he went into the military for 20 years. Yeah, he was an officer, so he didn't play around.
No. But because if it hit you, quickly. I remember I was about 8 years old, right? I remember hearing these kids who come up, they talk back to their parents, right? Talk back to their parents, right? And my mom told me, he said, I'm going to beat you. And I started hitting them back. As I looked up, I think that scene went to Kissy Joe. It took him three steps to get where we were at. Mm-hmm. He heard my dad and heard my mom say, Joe, put him down. He's out of the
That's what my dad was like. He had one rule. He said, if you ever lay your hand, I don't care if you're my kid, whoever. He said, if you ever lay your hand on a woman or my daughter, he said, you're dead.
That's right. You know what I told him? He said, because he said,
he's talking. He said, women. He said, this is the most precious jewel in the whole world. He said, one day you're going to appreciate it. And I did, because my wife now, she does everything. She cooks,
cleans up there. She takes care of me like,
but she's, it was this one lady. I know he didn't touch her. Matter of fact, the lady was around and told her, I just, you know, he said, I know it. If he knew what would happen to her.
Seeing she's from Mississippi, yeah. I remember when I left D.C. one time, I went to Mississippi, and I lived there a lot yet. Then you can backtrack and go over here.